I am Douglas Little, founder, perfumer, and creative director for Heretic Perfume. You are listening to the I Am Heretic podcast. These podcasts are an exploration of the senses with a focus on fragrance, how it's made, the effects it has, and the incredible people it has led me to meet. The heretic is a controversial figure. It's someone whose very essence defies the social norm and strays from the herd. The Greeks called those who went along orthodoxos, or having the right opinion. This week we venture into the unorthodox in a fascinating exploration of the history and mythology of one of the world's greatest heretics, the witch. We take on the unknown with our guide, the lovely Pam Grossman, who shares not just what she's learned from history, but what she practices in a conversation you may find truly heretical. Meet the witch.
First and foremost, I am a writer. I have a book out called Waking the Witch, Reflections on Women, Magic, and Power, wherein I really celebrate the archetype of the witch and talk about all of these different aspects of why witches matter, what a witch actually is. That's a question I get asked all the time. What is a witch? And it's actually really, really hard to answer because there are so many different associations we have with witches. And the witch occupies this strange mythical space that is sort of based in fact and sort of based in fiction, and it's constantly evolving. So my book is really about that, and it also talks about how, you know, our feelings about feminine power are often reflected in the witches that we gravitate towards. So those who are terrified of women having a lot of power will have a lot of villainous witches in their stories. Whereas now, and frankly, over the last 200 years or so, we've seen this reclamation of the witch as this powerful feminist icon. And that gives me a lot of hope, because to me, that means that we're getting more comfortable with the idea of complicated, powerful women and feminine people in general. So that is one big piece of what I do, is write and celebrate the archetype of the witch. I also have a podcast called The Witch Wave, and I have conversations with amazing visionaries who either represent or explore the archetype of the witch in their own work, or they might be literal magic practitioners. They might be someone like yourself, and you have an open invitation, of course, to be a guest on my podcast, because you are someone that I consider very magical. You're someone, I don't know if you identify as a witch or not, if that's a word that resonates with you, but I absolutely consider what you do to be in the world of magic. You are mindfully and intentionally using these ingredients to change people's consciousness. And what is magic if not that?
Your podcast really explores it from a very modern context. And I think that's what I really loved about listening to your podcast, is that it's quite esoteric. Do you know what I mean? A lot of your guests and whatnot are really, I think they're really outside thinkers. They really represent certainly, you know, the kind of heretical thinking and moving outside of what is the normal boundaries of even within the sphere of what is mysticism and the occult.
Thank you so much for saying that. And that's something that's been really important to me, is I want to expand the idea of what witches are and what magic is, because there aren't these crisp definitions anyway. And I think that people's intention and their energy and the current that they are carriers of has as much to do with magic as anything else. And so that's why, yes, on the podcast, I do have guests who identify as witches in the literal sense, and they cast spells and they worship the moon and all of that beautiful stuff, as I do too. But I also have tattoo artists and actors and, you know, drag queens, people who they might not use that word, at least not publicly, to identify. And yet what they are doing is so transformational. And I see them pulling on a lot of the techniques and a lot of the symbols that a more quote unquote traditional witch might be pulling from too.
So in jumping into that, let's start off with the very basics. And then we're going to really bring in the concept of how fragrance and herbalism play such a big part in it.
And it's always those basic questions that make me take that like deep breath, because there's not an easy way to answer it. I mean, I would argue, and many others would argue, that what we call witchcraft actually exists in virtually every culture around the world. Because to your earlier point, so many different cultures have long histories of magic, of what we might call alternative healing, which is actually, you know, natural healing, of doing some kind of energy work, of worshiping the ancestors, of getting messages from spirits, all of this, right? But when many of us use the term witchcraft today, we are often, not always, but often talking about what we might call British or English style witchcraft. That's certainly what has gotten popularized. And that is problematic in itself, because there are so many different cultures and traditions from the African diaspora, or, you know, my family is Jewish, and there's a lot of Jewish mysticism that has deeply influenced magic workers and practitioners around the world, and so on and so forth. South American magic, I mean, pick a culture and there's magic steeped in it. But I would argue that the idea we have of witchcraft and what is usually being referenced in pop culture often comes from this British folkloric world. And that is people who were what we might call pagan. I identify as pagan. And so these are folks who are worshiping, you know, certain deities. They are also celebrating around the cycles of the season and the cycles of the moon. And they are often doing spells. And spells are, what I would argue, are intentional, ritualized acts that use sympathetic magic often. In other words, they use real materials that are supposed to be stand-ins or metaphors for the kind of change or transformation that they are attempting to conjure. And witchcraft also has a lot to do, I think, with contacting spirits, contacting this, you know, unknowable, mysterious other world. And there are so many different definitions for what that other world is. Are we talking about ghosts? Are we talking about angels? Are we talking about gods? But I think that's an important thing to talk about too, is that there is this notion that there is more to the world than meets the eye, and witches have tools and skills that can help peel back the curtain of the material world and interface with the immaterial to make real transformations happen.
That's a really great way of putting it, and I think it helps to summarize it in a way that it makes a lot of sense. For me, the term witch and witchcraft, for me, and I think what really resonated with me early as a youth was, you know, I grew up quite religious with Irish Catholic, and of course, mysticism and the occult was so taboo and off the table. And my first introduction to it, my dad, I have no idea, gave me a pack of tarot cards at the age of 8. And I felt like when he just gave me a starter pack, and it was 22 major arcana cards. And I got those cards, and I remember being 8 years old, and I felt like I got the keys to a treasure box. And I remember just sitting in the car and poring over these cards and just so in rapture of the imagery, and trying to just, you know, as a child, my mind was just racing with like, what were these about, and wanting to understand them. So for me, there's always been, I've had an innate draw to it for some reason. And then as I started to go deeper into the symbolism of it, that's when I started, and also I think asking a lot of questions and wanting to be very skeptical about it. Certainly as an adult, you know, you start to ask these questions about your religion, you start to ask these questions about your spirituality, your reason for being, you know, how did we get here? All these questions. For me, what became very evident is that there's scientific fact that, you know, this cup that I'm drinking from, the plants that surround us, the table that this is all sitting on, that it's all made up of energy. That there is true scientific fact that these objects contain energetic sources, rocks, you know, all of these aspects. And one of my first teachers into mysticism said to me that the most powerful thing that I could do as a person of magic or a person wanting to study magic was to master meditation. And I remember feeling like, I'm really not that interested in meditation. Like, this just feels like, and I really realized that what was going on was that Mr. Miyagi was telling me to wax on, wax off, and I wasn't understanding it at all.
Yeah.
And, the concept of meditation, and I think now certainly as definitely doing this for a long time, meditation to me is actually going back to the root of me discovering those tarot cards for the first time. It is truly the most primal and important tool to mysticism and magic is about finding a way. And I consider that as humans that we're almost like tuning forks, and that if you can strike the tuning fork and resonate correctly with different aspects of energy that are coursing through us, around us at all times, that's when the magic can happen. And if you strip away all of the tools, you strip away, all of the sigils and the candle magic and all of these things, because truly they just are representational, that is where real magic begins. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, because let's be honest, you are not going to be able to find exactly the right ingredients from a British spell book in your backyard in suburban New Jersey, where I grew up, right? And that doesn't mean that the spell is not going to still work. It's not necessarily about the ingredient per se, although certainly I do think certain plants, and we'll talk about this, do have different energetic frequencies, to use your metaphor. But I also think it's very much about tapping into your own intuition, your own intention, your own attention. And so all of these materials become something that, yes, you are in relationship with. But I, to your point, think that the stronger we are in our own interior lives and our own interior energies, then the more powerful we can be when we are in relationship with these other elements. I absolutely think that magic is malleable, and that I think people make a mistake when they're first learning magic in assuming that they have to follow everything like they're following a recipe book. We've all had those little spell books, and a lot of people still go out and buy them. They want to know what's step one, step two, step three for a love potion, let's say. And I always tell people, think of it as learning to cook. When we're all learning to cook, yes, we might start with the recipes, but you don't become a chef until you start using your own intuition and customizing it and being like, oh crap, I don't have cinnamon, but I do have cardamom, and swapping out what you do have to hand. Certainly you want to learn the rules first. And I think spell books and recipe books are great for that. But I think everyone's magic is so personal, and our magic becomes even more potent the more personal and intuitive we get with it.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you wholeheartedly. There's obviously some very basic taboos around the term witch, and I'd love to hear how, if you've encountered any kickback from people on when you've introduced yourself as that. But I think what I'd love to first get into before we talk about that is the common misassociations that people have with the term witch and sure. Where they came from.
Absolutely. Well, the one that you will find most commonly brought up is that witches worship the devil, that we are satanic, diabolical, and all of that kind of association with true evil. And the fact of the matter is, the idea of the diabolical witch is a relatively new notion that was popularized a little bit before this, but really came to the fore at the end of the 15th century, and that got even more popular throughout the 16th and 17th century. And that is directly because of Christianity. And I want to preface this by saying, I do not have a problem with any religion. I think all religions have beauty and truth in them, and that includes Christianity. So I'm not trying to knock Christianity, in total. But the fact of the matter is that it was this Christian fear of women and sexuality and strangers, others, anybody who was not a generally white male, you know, God-fearing Christian, was considered diabolical. And what happened is there was the advent of the printing press that came up at the end of the 15th century. And so all of a sudden, you not only had this idea of this demonic, satanic, you know, sexual, deviant, homicidal witch, you had these books, these witch hunting manuals, which started getting reproduced and reproduced and reproduced. It's like the early idea of the meme, right? Suddenly this satanic witch, you see illustrations of her in these books and also in the fine art of the time. So early engravings by people like Albrecht Dürer really popularized this notion of this sexual temptress who would bring about your downfall and bring, you know, your damnation upon you. That got popularized as well. And these witch hunting manuals get disseminated throughout Western Europe. And, you know, that combined with evangelization and these friars going around and preaching about these diabolical witchy women caused what we know of as the witch craze or the witch hunts. And tens of thousands of people, mostly women, but certainly people of all genders, lost their lives because they were accused of being witches. And as we know, everything was blamed on witches. You know, if your crops failed, if your child died young, if you're having some kind of altercation with your neighbor, calling someone else or accusing them of being a witch, it was the perfect scapegoat mechanism. And so it really is a tragedy as well. I think, you know, many years later, there's so many parodies now of the witch hunts, you know, think of Monty Python or whatever. So we can certainly like laugh about it to some extent, but it was actually really horrific. And then, you know, later in the 17th century, it makes its way to the New England colonies. And of course, Salem gets a lot of the attention here in the US, but relatively few people lost their lives because of being accused of being a witch, as opposed to the tens of thousands who lost their lives in Europe.
So grisly.
I mean, yeah. It truly is, you know, and even people who didn't lose their lives, the torture techniques that were employed to get these quote unquote confessions out of people. I mean, they're monstrous. They're just the most grisly things you can imagine. And so, you know, that idea of the devil worshiping witch, it gets popularized because of horror movies, and I understand why. And people often ask me, like, does it bother me? Am I offended? It doesn't. I like horror movies also. I also have a sense of humor. And, you know, I think there's all kinds of ways that we can play with that side of the archetype of the witch. And I also think that side of the archetype is important to unpack because it reminds us of this history of misogyny and sexism that has been with us for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so I think there's a lot to learn from that side of the archetype. But it really wasn't until around the 19th century that we started to see the witch be reclaimed as this more sympathetic figure, you know, an oppressed woman who was not appreciated, who had all this innate natural magic within her. And, you know, the church therefore had to repress that because they were so threatened by that. So we have a lot of books that came out in the 19th century. The one I talk about a lot is this book called La Sorcière, which came out. It's by this French writer named Jules Michelet. And he writes about the witch. It's really beautiful. It's translated into English, but he writes about the witch as, you know, this very sympathetic woman who has all this power and this natural magic, and that the church finds her so threatening that that's why they kill her. And that is based on very faulty history. That is probably not why a lot of these people were accused of being witches throughout, you know, the many hundreds of years of the witch hunts. You know, there is this kind of, I'll call it fantasy. It's a dark fantasy that the women who were killed actually were witches, and the church was so threatened by them that they had to snuff them out. And historians have now pretty much proven that those people probably were not practicing some kind of witchcraft, that they were probably, you know, I mean, there's many, many reasons why they might have been accused or killed. And yet that notion of this woman who taps into this magic that is so threatening to the church lives on today. What also happened is, you know, during the 19th century, you have the suffragist movement, you know, women, it's the first wave of feminism happening. And so the image of the witch gets taken up by a lot of early feminists as this sympathetic figure that they can suddenly relate to and want to reclaim. And, you know, my book details that in a lot of detail, more detail than we can get into today. But, you know, I often talk about The Wizard of Oz as really giving us some great PR, because L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, his mother-in-law was an early, you know, feminist, and she wrote this book called Woman, Church, and State, where she talks about witches as these brilliant women who, you know, were so threatening to the church that they were accused of being witches and they lost their lives because of it. And he's so inspired by this notion that he writes this whole world, which is, if you think about it, a matriarchy. It's four powerful witches who are in charge of Oz. We see Glinda, the good witch, who's the early, you know, one of the earliest positive, popular good witches, who's then injected into the bloodstream of our culture in 1939 through the MGM movie. So, you know, there's a lot of other, you know, kind of nuance to this story of how witches went from evil to positive. But The Wizard of Oz is really one of the big reasons. And the final point I'll say about this is, you know, we haven't yet talked about Wicca and kind of the modern witchcraft movement, but that was essentially born from this man, Gerald Gardner, who you might have heard of, Douglas, who was this English witch, a dude, who... I mean, the story goes, and we don't quite understand the veracity of this yet, but he alleges in his writing that he was part of another coven, and he finds this coven so transformative, and that's why he starts his own. So he's not really saying that he invented the modern religion of Wicca, but a lot of people trace him as kind of the catalyst for Wicca. He writes a lot of books, he starts this whole movement, and Wicca kind of spreads throughout England, and it's brought over to the US in around the 1960s. It's then kind of popularized and reclaimed again by feminists who come up with feminist Wicca. And the story goes from there. And Wicca is a real religion that a lot of people practice. And also based on some faulty history and misunderstanding. And that's why it's so hard to talk about the witch, because, you know, a lot of our understanding of what a witch is based in these fantasies and fears. And that's why I think talking about witches as an archetype, or talking about it from this archetypal energy perspective, is almost more satisfying and more illuminating than trying to define, well, what is a witch and what isn't a witch?
It makes perfect sense. And I think even winding it backwards even further, you know, the root word of witch means wise or wise person. And, you know, I think that, again, you know, you can take with it what you want, but, you know, the concept of organized religion is very threatened by outside knowledge. You know what I mean? Knowledge that could be perceived as being threatening. And so I think that there's a lot of connections between that. I think helping people understand a little bit too about the traditional celebration of the seasons, because the concept of witchcraft is very much founded on, as you said earlier, following the seasons, following the lunar cycles, and a very much this deep, deep connection to nature. And there's all sorts of different sects within the term witchcraft and people of paganism and that celebrate these different holidays, which is, even for me, the more I study, the more I'm fascinated to see these new, like, these new offshoots of it that have started, you know, that I've never even heard of just recently. I mean, I started learning about fairy magic, which again, like, you put a label on it and immediately it conjures this very specific idea. And then as I started to dig into the weeds on it, I was like, okay, now I understand it a little bit more and it can, I see where the parallels are, but there's all sorts of these really unbelievable new offshoots of the core of it. I think bringing it into helping people understand where some of the roots of these came from is, again, going back into the concept of the Crusades and when there was, you know, the Crusades were coming across Europe and hoping to transform, you know, everyone into being God-fearing Christians or, you know, Catholics or what have you. There was this adaptation of what was like primitive folk medicine, primitive folk celebrations, and those became part because to gather a large group of people, it was easier to adopt existing holidays than it was to try to get them to follow these new foreign holidays. So, you know, again, I think because we're right in the middle of October, it's great to talk about, you know, All Hallows Eve, Samhain, and discuss how that kind of came about because it's such a peculiar holiday. And I think a lot of people, you know, we grow up with it, we just accept it for what it is, and we never really want to dig into the undercurrent of it. But it's, I think, really one of the most fascinating of the holidays, and that was one that was the church tried to stamp out for so many years, and it just wouldn't die. I mean, it really wouldn't go away. And I think, again, as humans, we all have an innate fear of death. And whether you look at death as being something that is a new beginning or an ending, the end of October marks when, you know, typical crops would be dying because of the cold and frost and the way that the, you know, the local people would adapt this was through this celebration. And again, it goes into the, you know, the basics of the Celtic religion and all of those things. But would you unpack this a little bit?
Sure. And I'll add to what you said that there are so many churches, especially in Western Europe, where you'll enter a church and then suddenly you'll see that there's all these pagan icons all over it. You will find pentacles. You will find creatures like Shilana Giggs and, you know, all of these Green Man, you know, all of these different deities. So oftentimes the churches were built on holy pagan sites and they would incorporate the local deities into the architecture, into the ritual. And many people argue that a lot of Christianity especially has been mapped onto and adapted from all of these more pagan holidays. And, you know, lots of people have pointed this out, but even the story of Jesus dying and then being resurrected, this is a story that occurs in so many different agrarian early societies because the crops die and then they, you know, seem to magically get reborn in the spring. You know, you think about Osiris is a god who dies and is resurrected again. Certainly there are Celtic gods who die and are resurrected again. So even that very story, the main story of Christianity has much older roots. And so anyhow, yeah, Samhain is such a beautiful holiday. And for me, people often ask me how I celebrate Halloween. And I think they're a little bit disappointed to hear that it's actually a very somber holiday for me, because it is a holiday about contacting your ancestors and honoring your ancestors. It's a very reverential holiday. And that's not to say that I don't also watch horror movies and eat a shit ton of candy and sometimes dress up. Like, I totally do all that stuff too. But when I'm, you know, wearing my actual like pagan witch hat and marking that occasion, what it looks like is, you know, certainly working at my altar, I'm giving thanks to my ancestors. I'm lighting candles for them. I'm often doing divination on that night because there is this theory that if you're doing divination, and for those who don't know what I mean by that, you know, any kind of what we might call fortune telling, or, you know, it could be using tarot cards, it could be, you know, casting runes or I Ching coins, whatever it is, things that are supposed to give you guidance from the spirit world, whether that's, you know, guidance about what you need to know right now, or some people think it can predict the future. You'll hear a whole host of different analysis on that. But the belief is that because your ancestors are allegedly more present that evening, that you'll get stronger readings through whatever divinatory method that you're using. So I often will do divination for sowing as well. There's also a beautiful ritual called the Dumb Supper or the Silent Supper, which I will, it's so beautiful. And essentially what that looks like is having a gorgeous, lavish feast with, you know, your loved ones or your community, but you set out a place for, you know, essentially you're leaving an empty chair, but you are filling the plate and feeding that spirit or those spirits with as much food and as much generosity as you are the people who are here in the material world eating that food. And traditionally, we do not say a word as we eat. That is why it is called the Dumb Supper or the Silent Supper. So you're doing that out of respect for your spirits. And then after the supper is complete, you can then leave that food that you left for the spirits on your altar or leave it outside. I love to do it at a crossroads because the goddess Hecate or Hecate is very, very precious to me, the Greek goddess of the crossroads and witchcraft and magic. You know, it's a beautiful holiday, but it's not the crazy reverie or revelry that a lot of people often associate with Halloween. And you know, this holiday comes from this tradition of absolutely, you know, marking the final harvest when the field is going to lay fallow. It's also marking a time when, I mean, there's the belief that, and you'll hear this a lot, that the veil between worlds is thinnest around this time of year, and especially around Samhain. And to that point, you know, there is this notion that we are closer to the other side, to the world of death. And that is still the ultimate mystery. With all of our science and all of our development as humans, we still don't know what happens when we die. Like, that's pretty mind-blowing, right? And it's going to happen to all of us. And that's also terrifying and perhaps inspiring. And to have a holiday that gives us tools to process this and to give thanks to those who came before us, whether literally or metaphorically, I think is so beautiful and so necessary too.
Absolutely. And, you know, this tradition that we're talking about is one that is traced back as far as you can go, that this was a time of year, and funny enough, across many, many, many cultures, that the end of October, beginning of November was a time of, you know, the Chinese, the Spanish, this was very much a part of the ingrained folk culture that was done. And, you know, the Crusades adopted this time of year, and I believe it was originally trying to be stamped out and then reclaimed, I think around November 1st or November 2nd as All Saints Day. So, and that was a time for, you know, the Christian religion to remember the saints that had passed and done good deeds. And then it just wouldn't go away. Like there was still this undercurrent of the bonfires that were being set, which was a very primitive tradition. The belief was is that the energy from the bonfires would be there to bring back the sun, and that the sun would then bring great crops. And so there was all of these great things that would happen. And then of course the youth got tied up into it, and the youth wanted to do things that were irreverent and fun. And this, you know, it's these traditions just kept morphing and morphing, and it just finally now here we are, and you know, 2020, and we've got this, you know, wild holiday that's wildly commercial, and yet at the same time it's steeped in tradition. And you know, it's just a fascinating time of year to kind of talk about the nuances of it and to understand, like, why is it that, you know, starting now, I mean, it starts so early, but why is it starting, you know, beginning of September, you walk into your local grocery store and there's images of, you know, witches and skeletons and ghosts and ghouls. everywhere. And I think it's something that's traced so far back. It's so fascinating to really understand the iconography and why these, you know, where the jack-o'-lantern came from and why it, you know, why it actually exists. And, you know, we do these kind of, it's almost like going to get a Christmas tree. We don't even think about why we do it. We just go and do it. And there's these really important historical facts that are tied to it and tied to these nature religions, and that they've somehow managed to perpetuate themselves all the way into our crazy modern culture.
Beautifully said. And that reminds me, we didn't even touch on why people dress up for Halloween in the first place. And there's a lot of different theories about that. But one is that if the veil between worlds is thinnest and all these spirits, some benevolent, but some malevolent, are suddenly, you know, walking the world again, that you'd want to protect yourself from that. So if you dress up, the spirits might think you were one of them, and so they wouldn't bother you. And that's also, so, you know, first of all, it's just tricking them, but it's also what we might call apotropaic magic. And I love that word. It essentially means protective magic. Mm. And I love this idea of dressing up as the thing that scares you. And as of, you know, taking that which we are most afraid of and incorporating it into our psyches and our bodies, becoming it temporarily, in a consensual way, you know, inviting it in and almost making friends with this energy and entity, as opposed to letting it control you, I think is such a beautiful lesson in general for how we can deal with our fears as human beings.
Oh, you couldn't have said that better. You know, Carl Jung is one of my favorite, my favorite of the world of the mind and the study of psychology. And he has this work that he does called shadow work. And, you know, the mastery of the shadow for me is so interesting. I've talked about it so much in fragrance and in herbalism, is that, you know, there is no light without the dark. There is no dark without the light. And so when you talk about that concept of embodying something that terrifies you, it's kind of the core of what shadow work is. You know, within Jung's philosophy, you know, his thought was just like, if you have a fear of homeless people, that you should, in essence, you should figure out ways of actually doing that. Like, you need to face your fears is basically the core of what it is. And that only once you truly step into it and embody it, are you able to actually then become sympathetic to it. And you have a much deeper understanding as to why you have these reactions that you currently do. Now, I'm speaking from a psychological standpoint, and I think from you, the spiritual standpoint, and both are equally powerful, and they both play such an important part, you know, together in that conversation. So we've really, like, again, I knew this was going to happen. I knew that I wish that we could just do a series where we could take and do an hour on each subject, because it's so wonderful to get to speak with you. You're such a wealth of knowledge. And it's just so great to be able to have this banter with someone about these topics that I love so much. I really want to get into talking about herbalism and plants and why they have such a importance to the world of mysticism. Can you first start? I'd love to hear about your relationship with nature and plants. And I know that some that practice witchcraft, that there now is people that are really, they just call themselves green witches, mm-hmm. which is ones that just really focus purely on herbalism. But I'd love to understand how plants play a part in your work, and then why you think that they're such a big part of mysticism.
Yes. Well, I can certainly trace back to some of my earliest forays into witchcraft to these times when I was very young and I was playing in the woods in our backyard, and I felt like I was tapping into some kind of transcendent energy. So it started early. But then, to be honest with you, I kind of got away from nature for a long time because, look, I live in New York City. I've lived here since 1999. Absolutely, there are parks and there are trees. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. We have lots of beautiful nature here. But living in an urban environment has its own energy, and it is easy to feel cut off from the cycles of the season, the cycles of the moon, especially if you can't even see the moon out your window half the time, depending on the apartment building you live in, right? And so it was 2009. when I was starting to feel called, I can't even explain it, but I started to feel called to learn from a teacher and to work with a group of witches. Before that, I had always been what we call a solitary practitioner. It's basically someone who is self-taught, who practices sometimes in secret. But even if you are a public solitary practitioner, it just means, you know, you practice alone. So I suddenly had this urge to learn from somebody, and I didn't know how to find a teacher. You know, I tried Googling, I tried doing all that, but it just wasn't happening. And so what did I do? Well, I do what I always do when I'm in that situation. And I did this big, beautiful spell, just inviting a teacher to come into my life. And then through a whole series of synchronicities, which we don't have time to get into today, but lo and behold, I was brought to a woman named Robin Rose Bennett, who is a green witch. She is, you know, she's an elder. She's this incredible witch who's been doing green magic and herbalism, you know, in New York City. And now she lives, you know, more in the woods of New Jersey for decades and decades. And she's just a legendary person. And I started taking classes with her and then eventually joined, you know, her version of a coven. I apprenticed with her for many years. And it was through this work with Robin and the other witches in that circle that I just became more connected again, or reconnected to nature. And Robin taught us how all plants, they have physiological energy and they have magical energy. So when we were taught about each flower, each herb, and taught what to make with them, we were also taught how to meditate with them, how to tap into the energy of the plant, how to communicate with the plant. And we were taught about, you know, how a plant might be able to, I don't know, help with diabetes, but it can also help you connect to the goddess of the moon. And both of these things are true. It's this real holistic way of looking at nature, of honoring it. Again, I'll use that phrase of being in relationship with it, of asking permission instead of just, you know, taking what we need from it, but actually saying, hey, may I please use, you know, your petals, your stems, your leaves. And waiting for the answer, and also really plugging into the different energies of the seasonal changes and of the lunar changes that happen each month. And it was so profound for me, Douglas, because not only did I learn to honor nature again, but I learned to honor my body again, because, you know, there's that adage, as above, so below. Like, we are all microcosms of spirit. And the body, not just cisgender feminine or female bodies like mine, but all bodies have cycles and seasons to them. And I believe how we treat the earth and how we treat our bodies are pretty much mirrors of each other. You know, if we only value the earth as something that we can make money off of or that we can pillage, often people who have that attitude, they don't necessarily know how to honor their own bodies and to honor the aging process and to look at human beings as having value beyond just being conventionally attractive and making money, right? So it changed my life in profound ways. And now, you know, I certainly use plants in my self-care. I make infusions for my well-being, but I'm also very mindful about the plants I'm using in my spells and my rituals and my magic baths, in what perfume I'm wearing, what incense I'm burning. And so I think plant magic is honestly one of the most powerful ways that we can tap into the magic that's within us and around us at all times.
So you said it so beautifully. I think, you know, within the world of fragrance, it's fragrance is something that if you trace the parallels between fragrance, scented oils, and whether you call it hoodoo or you call it witchcraft or magic, it's one that, I mean, it goes all the way back to the Egyptians, where we can find, you know, very strong threads of how fragrance was used to enhance spirituality and to connect you or to bring you to a place of higher consciousness. And it's one that, you know, there's actual scientific fact with it that shows how these fragrances and through aromatherapy that it lifts you and it brings the brain to a place of, you know, calm. And also, you know, there's very basic aspects of calming aspects of how fragrance can lift the spirits and dispel depression. And then also how it can, you know, create arousal and can definitely increase libido. So I think that there's all of these, you know, the science is woven in with all of this mysticism, which is really interesting. And it's one that I get asked a lot of times with the fragrances that I develop. You know, I use a lot of terms that are, you know, quite avant-garde. And I, you know, one of our fragrances is called Poltergeist, and another one I do is called Smudge. And, you know, it's based off of a smudge stick, and I created a liquid version of it. And there is truly, you know, these are times when I'm really working in this world of what I'm calling, you know, functional fragrance, where they're fragrances that go beyond the cosmetic department and they really venture into something where I'm tapping into and utilizing their historical roots of what primitive tribes have used to do different cleansing or dispelling materials, and then trying to work them into something that smells really beautiful. Because I think that more than ever, especially this year, what we need more of in our daily lives is magic. You know, I think we really need that we need to have that connection to mind, body, and spirit more than ever. And to do it in a way where there is no guilt associated with it, where it's purely about this essence of self-discovery and connecting deeper to who we are as humans. And I think that these plants and these fragrances, they really, on no matter what level you take them, I think that they can really help you do that.
I agree. And I also think that fragrance can help us connect to the greater spirit around us, if you believe that such a thing exists. And so I love that certain plants and fragrances are associated with different deities or different myths. And, you know, there's certainly in witchcraft, there's all kinds of associations with different planets or different metals, different days of the week. I know people who, you know, because Friday is associated with the goddess Freya and that's associated with love, you know, on Fridays they wear red and they adorn themselves in rose oil. You know, they like live in this really intentionally magical way of trying to amp up those frequencies. And I think that's really exciting too. I'm not suggesting everyone has to do that, but it's really fun. You know, the ways we adorn ourselves, the jewelry that we wear, you know, it's talismanic. And I think, you know, I haven't seen that many people during quarantine, but I'm still wearing perfume all the time. It's not just about trying to like please my husband or please the people I see. I feel more empowered when I'm wearing my, you know, special oils and magic, and that has so much value too.
I always like to ask my guests a question about fragrance, and I'd love to hear your response to it. Can you share with us a surprising, an erotic, or a life-changing moment where fragrance was very much a pivotal part of it?
Oh, gosh. I love that question so much, and like 17 answers came to my head. All right. I'll talk a little bit erotic. This might be too much information. I love the smell of just like wood. So I love the smell of cedar and, you know, those kinds of scents. I love hinoki oil, like all of that kind of foresty smell. And for whatever reason, my husband kind of emits that fragrance. I don't know. I don't think it's his deodorant. Like, I think it's just some kind of subtle thing about his pheromones or his skin. I often tell him he smells like a freshly sharpened pencil. And I mean that as like the highest compliment possible. And so like, I like sometimes, you know, sniff around in his like little nooks and crannies. For those listening, I'm pointing to my armpit and my crook of my neck because, you know, that's often where we carry that kind of scent. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I love that man, but I think his kind of innate cedarness is part of it.
I love that. That's wonderful. And do you have a fragrance that you love to wear?
I do, but I feel like I'm cheating on you because it's not Heretic. It's just one I've worn for a really long time. It's a very small batch perfume house. I'm sure you know of Olo out of Portland, and their perfume Dark Wave I've just worn for like 1,000 years. So that's usually my daily. It has a big sandalwood scent, a little bit of cardamom. So yeah, things that make me smell a little bit incense-y, they tend to be what attracts me most. So I'd love to know which perfumes you have, Douglas, that fit that
bill. Oh, for me, what I like to wear? Oh,
And also what you make that has that incense-y kind of vibe that I might be attracted to.
Yeah, the package that I sent you, I'm anxious to hear your response to. I really think that you're going to love, probably my guess is going to be the Smudge, and maybe some of the Dirty Violet. Those might be really nice. So I'll be anxious to hear what your response is to those.
Thank you.
And Pam, thank you so much for your time. And I'm wishing you such a gorgeous October and looking forward to doing this again.
Back at you. This was such a pleasure. And I will come back as many times as you'll have me.